Are you coming?
In a few minutes.
Tegg took a deep breath, sensing how close he was to exhaustion. This afternoon on the practice floor and afterward had drained him. He watched Duncan leave. Where was Lucilla? What was she planning? How long could she wait? That was the central question, and it put the no-globe's peculiar emphasis on their isolation from time. Again he sensed that ebb and flow which their three lives influenced.
I must talk to Lucilla. Where's she gone? The library? No, there is something else I must do first.
Lucilla sat in the room she had chosen for her personal quarters. It was a small space with an ornate bed filling an inset into one wall. Gross and subtle signs around her said this had been the room of a favourite, Harkonnen Hetera. Pastel blues with darker blue accents shaded the fabrics. Despite the Baroque carvings on bed, alcove, ceiling, and every functioning appurtenance, the room itself could be swept out of her consciousness once she relaxed here. She lay back on the bed and closed her eyes against the sexually gross figures on the alcove ceiling.
Tegg will have to be dealt with.
It would have to be done in such a way that it did not offend Terraza or weaken the Gola. Tegg presented a special problem in many ways, especially in the way his mental processes could dip into and out of deeper sources akin to those of the Bene Gesserit.
The Reverend Mother, who bore him, of course.
Something passed from such a mother to such a child. It began in the womb and probably did not end even when they were finally separated. He had never undergone the all-ravening transmutation that produced abominations. No, not that. But he had subtle and real powers. Those born of reverent mothers learned things impossible to others. Tegg knew precisely how Lucilla viewed love in all of its manifestations. She had seen it on his face that once in his quarters at the keep.
Calculating witch.
He might as well have spoken it aloud. She recalled the way she had favoured him with her benign smile and dominating expression. That had been a mistake, demeaning to both of them. She sensed in such thoughts a latent sympathy for Tegg. Somewhere within her, despite all of the careful Bene Gesserit training, there were chinks in her armour. Her teachers had warned her about that many times.
To be capable of inducing real love, you must feel it, but only temporarily. And once is enough.
Tegg's reactions to the Duncan Idaho Gola said much. Tegg was both drawn to and repelled by their young charge.
As I am.
Perhaps it had been a mistake not to seduce Tegg. In her sex education, where she had been taught to gain strength from intercourse rather than lose herself in it, her teachers had emphasized analysis and historical comparisons, of which there were many in a reverend mother's other memories. Lucilla focused her thoughts on Tegg's male presence. Doing this, she could feel a female response, her flesh wanting Tegg close to her and aroused to sexual peak, ready for the moment of mystery. Faint amusement crept into Lucilla's awareness. Not orgasm. No scientific labels. It was purest Bene Gesserit cant, moment of mystery. The imprinter's ultimate specialty. Immersion in the long Bene Gesserit continuity required this concept. She had been taught to believe deeply in a duality, the scientific knowledge by which the breeding mistresses guided them, but, at the same time, the moment of mystery that confounded all knowledge. Bene Gesserit history and science said the procreative drive must remain irretrievably buried in the psyche. It could not be removed without destroying the species. The safety net. Lucilla gathered her sexual forces around her now as only a Bene Gesserit imprinter could. She began to focus her thoughts on Duncan. By now he would be in the showers and thinking about his evening's training session with his reverend mother teacher.
I will go to my student presently, she thought. The important lesson must be taught, or he will not be fully prepared for Rakus.
Those were Terraza's instructions. Lucilla swung the focus of her thoughts fully onto Duncan. It was almost as though she saw him standing naked under the shower. How little he understood of what there might be to learn. Duncan sat alone in the dressing cubicle off the showers which adjoined the practice hall. He was immersed in a deep sadness. This brought remembered pains to old wounds that this young flesh had never experienced. Some things never changed. The sisterhood was at its old, old games again. He looked up and around this dark-panelled Harkonnen place. Arabesques were carved into walls and ceiling, strange designs in the tessery of the floor, monsters and lovely human bodies intermingled across the same defining lines. Only a flicker of attention separated one from the other. Duncan looked down at this body that the Tleilaxu and their axolotl tanks had produced for him. It still felt strange at moments. He had been a man of many adult experiences in the last instant he remembered from his pre-Gola life, fighting off a swarm of Sardauka warriors, giving his young duke a chance to escape. His duke. Paul had been no older than this flesh then, conditioned, though, the way the Atreides always were, loyalty and honour above all else. The way they conditioned me after they saved me from the Harkonnens. Something within him could not evade that ancient debt. He knew its source. He could outline the process by which it had been embedded in him. There it remained. Duncan glanced at the tiled floor. Words had been worked in the tile along the cubicle's splashboard. It was a script that one part of him identified as an ancient thing from the old Harkonnen times, but that another part of him found to be an all-too-familiar Galak. Clean, sweet, clean, bright, clean, pure, clean. The ancient script repeated itself around the room's perimeter, as though the words themselves might create something that Duncan knew was alien to the Harkonnens of his memories. Over the door to the showers, more script. Confess thy heart and find purity. A religious admonition in a Harkonnen stronghold? Had the Harkonnens changed in the centuries after his death? Duncan found this hard to believe. These words were things that the builders probably had thought appropriate. He felt, rather than heard, Lucilla enter the room behind him. Duncan stood and fastened the clips of the tunic he had appropriated from the null entropy bins, but only after removing all Harkonnen insignia. Without turning, he said, "What now, Lucilla?" She stroked the fabric of the tunic along his left arm. "The Harkonnens had rich tastes." Duncan spoke quietly. "Lucilla, if you touch me again without my permission, I will try to kill you. I will try so hard that you very likely will have to kill me." She recoiled. He stared into her eyes. "I'm not some damned stud for the witches."
"Is that what you think we want of you?"
"Nobody has said what you want of me, but your actions are obvious." He stood poised on the balls of his feet. The unawakened thing within him stirred and sent his pulse racing. Lucilla studied him carefully.
"Damn that Miles Tegg."
She had not expected resistance to take this form. There was no doubting Duncan's sincerity. Words by themselves no longer would serve. He was immune to voice.
"Truth."
It was the only weapon left to her.
"Duncan, I do not know precisely what it is Terraza expects you to do on Rakkus. I can guess, but my guess may be wrong."
"Guess, then."
"There is a young girl on Rakkus, barely into her teens. Her name is Shiana. The worms of Rakkus obey her. Somehow the sisterhood must gather this talent into its own store of abilities."
"What could I possibly—"
"If I knew, I certainly would tell you now."
He heard her sincerity unmasked by her desperation. "What does your talent have to do with this?" he demanded.
"Only Terraza and her counselors know.
They want some hold on me, something from which I cannot escape." Lucilla already had arrived at this deduction, but she had not expected him to see it that quickly. Duncan's youthful face concealed a mind that worked in ways she had not yet fathomed. Lucilla's thoughts raced.
"Control the worms, and you could revive the old religion."
It was Tegg's voice from the doorway behind Lucilla.
"I did not hear him arrive."
She whirled. Tegg stood there with one of the antique Harkonnen laser guns held casually across his left arm, its muzzle directed at her.
"This is to ensure that you listen to me," he said.
"How long have you been there listening?"
Her angry glare did not change his expression.
"From the moment you admitted you don't know what Terraza expects of Duncan," Tegg said. "Nor do I, but I can make a few mentat projections. Nothing firm yet, but all of them suggestive. Tell me if I'm wrong."
"About what?"
He glanced at Duncan.
One of the things you were told to do was to make him irresistible to most women.
Lucilla tried to conceal her dismay. Terrazza had warned her to conceal this from Teg as long as possible. She saw that concealment no longer was possible. Teg had read her reaction with those damnable abilities imparted to him by his damnable mother.
A great deal of energy is being gathered and aimed at Rakkis, Teg said.
He looked steadily at Duncan.
No matter what the Trelaxo have buried in him, he has the stamp of ancient humankind in his genes. Is that what the breeding mistresses need?
A damned Bene Gesserit stud, Duncan said.
What do you intend to do with that weapon? Lucilla asked.
She nodded at the antique laser gun in Teg's hands.
This? I didn't even put a charge cartridge in it.
He lowered the laser gun and leaned it into a corner beside him.
Miles Teg, you will be punished, Lucilla grated.
That will have to wait, he said. It's almost night outside. I've been out there under the life shield. Where's Marley has been here. He has left his sign to tell me he read the message I scratched with those animal marks on the trees.
A glittering alertness came into Duncan's eyes.
What will you do? Lucilla asked.
I have left new marks arranging a rendezvous. Right now, we are all going up to the library. We are going to study the maps. We will commit them to memory. At the very least, we should know where we are when we run.
She gave him the benefit of a curt nod. Duncan noted her movement with only part of his awareness. His mind already had leaped ahead to the ancient equipment in the Harkonnen Library. He had been the one to show both Lucilla and Teg how to use it correctly, calling up an ancient map of Gedi Prime dating from the time when the No-Globe had been built. With Duncan's pre-Gola memory as guide and his own more modern knowledge of the planet, Teg had tried to bring the map up to date. Forest Guard Station became Bene Gesserit Keep.
Part of it was a Harkonnen hunting lodge, Duncan had said. They hunted human game raised and conditioned specifically for that purpose.
Towns vanished under Teg's updating. Some cities remained but received new labels. Yasai, the nearest metropolis, had been marked Barony on the original map. Duncan's eyes went hard in memory.
That's where they tortured me.
When Teg exhausted his memory of the planet, much was marked unknown, but there were frequent curly-ended Bene Gesserit symbols to identify the places where Terrazza's people had told Teg he might find temporary sanctuary. Those were the places Teg wanted committed to memory. As he turned to lead them up to the library, Teg said,
I will erase the map when we have learned it. There's no telling who might find this place and study it.
Lucilla swept past him.
It's on your head, Miles, she said.
Teg called after her, retreating back.
A mentat tells you that I did what was required of me.
She spoke without turning.
How logical.
This room reconstructs a bit of the desert of Dune. The sand crawler directly in front of you dates from the Atreides times. Grouped around it, moving clockwise from your left, are a small harvester, a carryall, a primitive spice factory, and the other support equipment. All are explained at each station. Note the illuminated quotation above the display. For they shall suck of the abundance of the seas and of the treasure in the sand. This ancient religious quotation was oft repeated by the famous Gurney Halleck. Guide announcement. Museum of Dar es Balat. The worm did not slow its relentless progress until just before dusk. By then, Odraid had played out her questions, and still had no answers. How did Shiana control the worms? Shiana said she was not steering her shaitan in this direction. What was this hidden language to which the desert monster responded? Odraid knew that her sister guardians up there in the thopters that paced them would be exhausting the same questions, plus one more. Why did Odraid let this ride continue? They might even hazard a few guesses. She does not call us in because that might disturb the beast. She does not trust us to pluck her party from its back. The truth was far simpler. Curiosity. The hissing passage of the worm could have been a surging vessel breasting seas. The dry, flinty odors of overheated sand swept across them by a following wind said otherwise. Only open desert stretched around them now, kilometer after kilometer of whaleback dunes as regular in their spacing as ocean waves. Woff had been silent for a long period. He crouched in a miniature reproduction of O'Drade's position, his attention directed ahead, a blank expression on his face. His most recent statement, "God guard the faithful in the hour of our trial!" O'Drade thought of him as living proof that a strong enough fanaticism could endure for ages. Zen Sunni and the old Sufi survived in the Tlaylaxu. It was like a deadly microbe that had lain dormant all of those millennia, waiting for the right host to feed its virulence. "What will happen to the thing I planted in the Rakian priesthood?" she wondered. Saint Shiana was a certainty. Shiana sat on a ring of her shaitan, her robe pulled up to expose her thin shanks. She gripped the ring with both hands between her legs. She had said that her first worm ride went directly to the city of Keen. Why there? Had the worm simply been taking her to her own kind? This one beneath them now certainly had a different goal. Shiana no longer questioned, but then O'Drade had ordered her to remain silent and practice the low trance. That, at least, would assure that every last detail of this experience could be recalled easily from her memory. If there were a hidden language between Shiana and Worm, they would find it later. O'Drade peered at the horizon. The remnant base of the ancient wall around the Sarir was only a few kilometers ahead. Long shadows from it lay across the dunes, telling O'Drade that the remnant was higher than she had originally suspected. It was a shattered and broken outline now, with great boulders strewn along its base. The notch where the tyrant had tumbled from his bridge into the Idaho River lay well to their right, at least 3 kilometers off their path. No river flowed there now. Waff stirred beside her.
"I heed thy call, God," he said. "It is Waff of the Entio who prays in thy holy place."
O'Drade swiveled her gaze toward him without moving her head. Entio? Her other memories knew an Entio, a tribal leader in the great Zen Sunni wandering, long before Dune. What was this? What ancient memories did these Tlaylaxu keep alive? Shiana broke her silence.
"Shaitan is slowing."
The remains of the ancient wall blocked their way. It loomed at least 50 meters over the highest dunes. The worm turned slightly to the right and moved between 2 giant boulders that towered above them. It came to a stop. The long-ridged back lay parallel to a mostly intact section of the wall's base. Shiana stood and looked at the barrier.
"What is this place?"
Waff asked. He raised his voice above the sound of the thopters circling overhead. O'Drade released her tiring grip and flexed her fingers. She continued to kneel while she studied their surroundings. Shadows from the tumbled boulders drew hard lines on sand spills and smaller rocks. Seen close up, not 20 meters away, the wall revealed cracks and fissures, dark openings into the ancient foundation. Waff stood and massaged his hands.
"Why have we been brought here?"
he asked. His voice was faintly plaintive. The worm twitched.
"Shaitan wants us to get off," Shiana said.
"How does she know?" O'Drade wondered.
The worm's movement had not been enough to make any of them stumble. It could have been some private reflex after the long journey. But Shiana faced the ancient wall's foundation, sat down on the curve of the worm, and slid off. She dropped in a crouch on soft sand. O'Drade and Waff moved forward and watched with fascination as Shiana slogged through the sand to the front of the creature. There, Shiana placed both hands on her hips and faced the gaping mouth. Hidden flames played orange light across the young face.
"Shaitan, why are we here?" Shiana demanded.
Again the worm twitched.
"He wants all of you off him," Shiana called.
Waff looked at O'Drade.
"If God wishes thee to die, he causes thy steps to lead thee to the place of thy death."
O'Drade gave him back a paraphrase from the cant of the Shariat.
"Obey God's messenger in all things."
Waff sighed. Doubt was plain on his face. But he turned and was first off the worm, dropping just ahead of O'Drade. They followed Shiana's example, moving to the front of the creature. O'Drade, every sense alert, fixed her gaze on Shiana. It was much hotter in front of the gaping mouth. The familiar bite of melange filled the air around them.
"We are here, God,"
Waff said. Audrade, getting more than a little tired of his religious awe, spared a glance for their surroundings. The shattered rocks, the eroded barrier reaching into the dusky sky, sand sloping against the time-scarred stones, and the slow, scorching huff-huff of the worm's internal fires.
But where is here? Audrade wondered. What is special about this place to make it the worm's destination?
Four of the watching thopters passed in line overhead, the sound of their wing fans and the hissing jets momentarily drowned out the worm's background rumblings.
Shall I call them down? Audrade wondered.
It would take only a hand signal. Instead, she lifted two hands in the signal for the watchers to remain aloft. Evening's chill was on the sand now. Audrade shivered and adjusted her metabolism to the new demands. She felt confident that the worm would not engulf them with Shiana beside them. Shiana turned her back on the worm.
He wants us to be here, she said.
As though her words were a command, the worm twisted its head away from them and slid off through the tall scattering of giant boulders. They could hear it speeding away back into the desert. Audrade faced the base of the ancient wall. Darkness would be upon them soon, but enough light remained in the high desert's long dusk that they might yet see some explanation of why the creature had brought them here. A tall fissure in the rock wall to her right seemed as good a place to investigate as any. Keeping part of her attention on the sounds from Wuff, Audrade climbed a sandy incline toward the dark opening. Shiana kept pace with her.
Why are we here, Mother?
Audrade shook her head. She heard Wuff following. The fissure directly in front of her was a shadowy hole into darkness. Audrade stopped and held Shiana beside her. She judged the opening to be about a meter wide and some four times that in height. The rocky sides were curiously smooth, as though polished by human hands. Sand had drifted into the opening. Light from the setting sun reflected off the sand to bathe one side of the opening in a wash of gold. Wuff spoke from behind them.
What is this place?
There are many old caves, Shiana said. Fremen hid their spice in caves.
She inhaled deeply through her nose.
Do you smell it, Mother?
There was a definite mélange odor to the place, Audrade agreed. Wuff moved past Audrade and into the fissure. He turned there, looking up at the walls where they met in a sharp angle above him. Facing Audrade and Shiana, he backed farther into the opening, his attention on the walls. Audrade and Shiana stepped closer to him. With an abrupt hissing of spilled sand, Wuff vanished from their sight. In the same instant, the sand all around Audrade and Shiana slipped forward into the fissure, dragging both of them with it. Audrade grabbed Shiana's hand.
Mother!
Shiana cried. The sound echoed from invisible rock walls as they slid down a long slope of spilling sand into concealed darkness. The sand drifted them to a stop in a final wash of gentle movement. Audrade, in sand up to her knees, extricated herself and pulled Shiana with her onto a hard surface. Shiana started to speak, but Audrade said,
Hush, listen.
There was a grating disturbance off to the left.
Wuff?
I'm in it, up to my waist.
There was terror in his voice.
Audrade spoke dryly. God must want it that way. Pull yourself out gently. It feels like rock under our feet. Gently now, we don't need another avalanche.
As her eyes adjusted, Audrade looked up the sand slope down which they had tumbled. The opening where they had entered this place was a distant slit of dusky gold far away above them.
Mother,
Shiana whispered,
I'm scared.
Say the litany against fear, Audrade ordered, and be still. Our friends know we are here. They will help us get out.
God has brought us to this place,
Wuff said. Audrade did not respond. In the silence, she pursed her lips and gave a high-pitched whistle, listening for the echoes. Her ears told her they were in a large space with some sort of low obstruction behind them. She turned her back on the narrow fissure and gave another whistle. The low barrier lay about 100 meters away. Audrade freed her hand from Shiana's.
Stay right here, please.
Wuff?
I hear the thopters,
he said.
We all hear them, Audrade said. They are landing. We will have help presently. Meanwhile, please stay where you are and remain silent. I need the silence.
Whistling and listening for the echoes, placing each foot carefully, Odraid worked her way deeper into the darkness. An outstretched hand encountered a rough rock surface. She felt along it, only about waist high. She could feel nothing beyond it. The echoes of her whistles said it was a smaller space there and partly enclosed. A voice called from high behind her.
Reverend Mother, are you there?
Odraid turned, cupped her hands around her mouth, and shouted,
Stay back! We've been spilled into a deep cave. Bring a light and a long rope.
A tiny dark figure moved back out of the distant opening. The light up there was growing dimmer. She lowered her cupped hands and spoke into the darkness.
Shiana? Waf? Come toward me about 10 paces and wait there.
Where are we, Mother?
Shiana asked.
Patience, child.
A low muttering sound came from Waf. Odraid recognized the ancient words of the Islamiyat. He was praying. Waf had dropped all attempts to conceal his origins from her. Good. The believer was a receptacle for her to feed with the sweets of the Missionaria Protectiva. Meanwhile, the possibilities of this place where the worm had brought them excited Odraid. Guided by one hand on the rock barrier, she explored along it to her left. The top was quite smooth in places. All of it sloped inward away from her. Other memories offered a sudden projection.
Catch basin.
This was a Fremen water storage basin. Odraid inhaled deeply, testing for moisture. The air was flint dry. A bright light from the fissure stabbed downward, driving away the darkness. A voice called from the opening, and Odraid recognized it as one of her sisters.
We can see you!
Odraid stepped back from the low barrier and turned, peering all around. Waf and Shiana stood about 60 meters away, staring at their surroundings. The chamber was roughly circular, some 200 meters in diameter. A rock dome arched high overhead. She examined the low barrier beside her. Yes, a Fremen catch basin. She could discern the small rock island in its center, where a captive worm could be kept ready to spill into the water. Other memories replayed that agonized, twisting death which produced the spice poison to ignite a Fremen orgy. A low arch framed more darkness on the far side of the basin. She could see the spillway there where water had been brought down from a wind trap. There would be more catch basins back there, an entire complex of them designed to hold a wealth of moisture for an ancient tribe. She knew the name of this place now.
Siech Tabur, Odraid whispered.
The words ignited a flood of useful memories. This had been Stilgar's place in the time of Muad'Dib.
Why did that worm bring us to Siech Tabur?
A worm took Shiana to the city of Keen, that others might know of her? Then what was there to know here? Were there people back there in that darkness? Odraid sensed no indications of life in that direction. Her sister at the opening interrupted these thoughts.
We've had to ask for the rope to be brought from Dar es Balat. The people at the museum say this is probably Siech Tabur. They thought it had been destroyed.
Send down a light so I can explore it, Odraid called.
The priests ask that we leave it undisturbed.
Send me a light, Odraid insisted.
Presently a dark object tumbled down the sand slope in a small spill of sand. Odraid sent Shiana scampering for it. A touch on the switch and a bright beam went lancing at the dark archway beyond the catch basin. Yes, more basins there. And beside this basin, a narrow stairway cut into the rock. The steps led upward, turning and removing themselves from her view. Odraid bent and whispered in Shiana's ear.
Watch Waf carefully. If he moves after us, call out.
Yes, Mother. Where are we going?
I must look at this place. I am the one who has been brought here for a purpose.
She raised her voice and addressed Waf.
Waf, please wait there for the rope.
What have you been whispering?
He demanded.
Why must I wait? What are you doing?
I have been praying, Odraid said. Now I must continue this pilgrimage alone.
Why alone?
In the old language of the Islamiyat, she said, It is written.
That stopped him. Odraid led the way at a fast walk toward the rock stairs. Shiana, hurrying along beside Odraid, said,
We must tell people about this place. The old Fremen caves are safe from Shaitan.
Be still, child, Odraid said.
She aimed the light up into the stairway. It curved through the rock, angling sharply to the right up there. Odrade hesitated. The warning sense of danger she had felt at the beginning of this venture came back intensified. It was an almost palpable thing within her. What is up there?
Wait here, Shiana, Odrade said. Don't let Waf follow me.
How can I stop him?
Shiana glanced fearfully back across the chamber where Waf stood.
Tell him it is God's will that he remain. Say it this way.
Odrade bent close to Shiana and repeated the words in Waf's ancient language. Then,
say nothing else. Stand in his way and repeat it if he tries to pass.
Shiana mouthed the new words quietly. She had them, Odrade saw. The girl was quick.
He's afraid of you, Odrade said. He won't try to harm you.
Yes, mother.
Shiana turned, folded her arms across her breast, and looked across the chamber at Waf. Aiming the light ahead of her, Odrade went up the rock stairs.
Sietch Tabor, what surprise have you left for us here, old worm?
In a long, low hallway at the top of the stairs, Odrade came on the first, desert mummified bodies. There were five of them, two men and three women, no identifying marks or clothing on them. They had been completely stripped and left for the desert's dryness to preserve. Dehydration had pulled skin and flesh tightly around the bones. The bodies were propped in a row, their feet extending across the passage. Odrade was forced to step over each of these macabre obstructions. She passed her hand light across each body as she went. They had been stabbed almost identically. A slashing blade had been thrust upward just below the arch of the sternum. Ritual killings? Dryly puckered flesh had been withdrawn from the wounds, leaving a dark spot to mark them. These bodies were not from Fremen times, Odrade knew. Fremen death stills made ashes of all flesh to recover a body's water. Odrade probed ahead with her light and paused to consider her position. Discovery of the bodies intensified her sense of peril.
I should have brought a weapon.
But that would have aroused Waf's suspicions. The persistence of that inner warning could not be evaded. This relic of Sietch Tabor was perilous. The beam of her light revealed another stairway at the end of this hall. Cautiously, Odrade moved forward. At the first step, she sent the beam of her light probing upward. Shallow steps. Only a little way up, more rock. A wider space up there. Odrade turned and sent the light stabbing around this hallway. Chips and burn marks scarred the rock walls. Once more, she looked up the stairway.
What is up there?
The sense of danger was intense. One slow step at a time, pausing often, Odrade climbed. She emerged into a larger passage hewn through the native rock. More bodies greeted her. These had been abandoned in the disarray of their final moments. Again she saw only mummified flesh, stripped of clothing. They lay scattered along this wider passage, 20 of them. She wove her way around them. Some had been stabbed in the same way as the five on the lower level. Some had been slashed and hacked and burned by laser gun beams. One had been beheaded, and the skin-masked skull lay against the wall of the passage like a ball abandoned from some terrible game. This new passage led straight ahead past openings into small chambers on both sides. She saw nothing of value in the small chambers where she sent her probing light. A few scattered strands of spice fiber, small spills of melted rock, melt bubbles occasionally on floors, walls, and ceilings.
What violence was this?
Suggestive stains could be seen on some of the chamber floors.
Spilled blood?
One chamber had a tiny mound of brown cloth in a corner, scraps of torn fabric scattered under Odrade's foot. There was dust. Dust everywhere. Her feet stirred it up in passing. The passage ended at an archway that gave onto a deep ledge. She sent her light beyond the ledge, an enormous chamber, far larger than the one down below. Its curved ceiling went so high she knew it must extend into the rock base of the great wall. Wide, shallow steps led down from the ledge onto the chamber floor. Hesitantly, Odrade went down the steps and out onto the floor. She sent her light sweeping all around. Other passages led out of the great chamber. Some, she saw, had been blocked by stone, and the stones torn away to be left scattered on the ledge and on this great floor. Odraid sniffed the air. Carried on the dust stirred up by her feet, there was a definite smell of melange. The smell wove through her sense of peril. She wanted to leave, hurry back to the others. But the danger was a beacon. She had to learn where that beacon led. She knew where she was now, though. This was the great gathering chamber of Siech Tabor, site of countless Fremen spice orgies and tribal convocations. Here, the Naib Stilgar had presided, Gurney Halleck had been here, the Lady Jessica, Paul Muad'Dib, Cheney, mother of Ghanima. Here, Muad'Dib trained his fighters. The original Duncan Idaho was here, and the first Idaho Gola.
Why have we been brought here? What is the danger?
It was here, right here. She could feel it. In this place, the tyrant had concealed a spice hoard. Bene Gesserit records said the hoard had filled this entire chamber to the ceiling and into many of the surrounding passages as well. Odraid pivoted, her gaze following the path of her light. Over there was the ledge of the Naibs, and there the deeper royal ledge Muad'Dib had commissioned.
And there is the archway where I entered.
She sent her light along the floor, noting places where searchers had chipped and burned the rock, seeking more of the tyrant's fabulous hoard. Fish speakers had taken most of that melange, its hiding place revealed by the Idaho Gola who had been consort of the famed Siona. The records said subsequent searchers had found more caches hidden behind false walls and floors. There were many authenticated accounts and the verifications of other memories. The famine times had seen violence here when desperate searchers won through to this place. That might explain the bodies. Many had fought just for the chance to search Siech Tabor. As she had been taught, Odraid tried to use her sense of danger as a guide. Did the miasma of past violence cling to these stones after all of those millennia? That was not her warning. Her warning was something immediate. Odraid's left foot encountered an uneven place on the floor. Her light picked out a dark line in the dust. She scattered the dust with a foot, revealing a letter. And then an entire word burned in a flowing script. Odraid read the word silently and then aloud. Aerophel. She knew this word. Reverend Mothers of the Tyrant's time had impressed it into the Bene Gesserit consciousness, tracing its roots out to the most ancient sources. Aerophel, the cloud darkness at the end of the universe. Odraid felt the gasping accumulation of her warning sense. It focused on that single word. The tyrant's holy judgment, the priests called that word. The cloud darkness of holy judgment. She moved out along the word, staring down at it, noting the curling at the end that trailed off into a small arrow. She looked where the arrow pointed. Someone else had seen the arrow and cut into the ledge where it pointed. Odraid crossed to where the searcher's burner had left a darker pool of melted rock on the chamber floor. Streams of melted stone ran out in fingers away from the ledge, each finger trailing from a deep hole burned into the rock of the ledge. Bending, Odraid peered into each hole with her light. Nothing. She sensed the treasure hunter's excitement riding on her warning fear. The extent of the wealth this chamber had once held staggered imagination. In the worst of the old times, a hand-carried luggage case could hold enough spice to buy a planet. And the fish speakers had squandered this hoard, losing it in squabbles and shattering misjudgments and ordinary foolishness too picayune for history to record. They had been glad to accept Ixion alliance when the Tleilaxu broke the melange monopoly.
Did the searchers find it all? The tyrant was superbly clever. Aerophel. At the end of the universe.
Had he sent a message down the eons to the Bene Gesserit of today? She cast the beam of her light once more around the chamber and then upward. The ceiling described an almost perfect half-globe overhead. It had been intended, she knew, as a model of the night sky seen from the entrance to Siech Tabor. But even by the time of Liet Kynes, the first planetologist here, the original stars painted on that ceiling had been gone, lost in the tiny rock chippings of small quakes and the everyday abrasions of life. Audrey's breath quickened. The sense of peril had never been greater. The danger beacon shone within her. Quickly, she trotted directly across to the steps where she had descended to this floor. Turning there, she cast backward in her mind for other memories to limn this place. They came slowly past that heart-pounding sense of doom. Pointing the beam of her light upward and peering along it, Audrey placed those ancient memories over the scene in front of her.
Bits of reflected brilliance.
Other memories positioned them, indicators of the stars in a long-gone sky, and right there, the silvery-yellow half-circle of the Arikine sun. She knew it for a sunset sign.
The Fremen day starts at night. Erephel.
Keeping her light on that sunset marker, she mounted the steps backward and went around the chamber on the ledge to the exact position she had seen in other memories. Nothing remained of that ancient sun arc. Searchers had chipped at the wall where it had been. Stone bubbles glistened where a burner had been passed along the wall. No breaks entered the original rock. By the tightness of her chest, Audrey knew she teetered on the edge of a dangerous discovery. The beacon had led her here.
Erephel, at the edge of the universe, beyond the setting sun.
She swept her light right and left. Another passage entrance opened on her left. Stones that had blocked it lay scattered on the ledge. Her heart pounding, Audrey slipped through the opening and found a short hall plugged with melted stone at the end. On her right, directly behind where the sunset marker had been, she found a small room thick with the smell of mélange. Audrey entered the room and saw more signs of chipping and burning on walls and ceiling. The danger sense was oppressive here. She chanted the litany against fear silently while she swept the beam of her light over the room. The place was almost square, about 2 meters on a side. The ceiling was less than half a meter above her head. Cinnamon pulsed in her nostrils. She sneezed and, blinking, saw a tiny discoloration on the floor beside the threshold. More marks of that ancient search? Bending close, with her light held at a sharp angle on one side, she saw that she had glimpsed only the shadow of something etched deeply into the rock. Dust concealed most of it. She knelt and brushed the dust aside. Very thin etching, and very deep. Whatever this was, it had been meant to endure. The last message of a lost Reverend Mother? This was a known Bene Gesserit artifice. She pressed sensitive fingertips against the etching and reconstructed its tracery in her mind. Recognition leapt into her awareness. One word inscribed in ancient Chakobsa, here. This was no ordinary here to mark an ordinary place, but the accented and emphatic here that said, you have found me. Her hammering heart emphasized it. Audrey rested her handlight on the floor near her right knee and let her fingers explore the threshold beside that ancient summons. The stonework appeared unbroken to the eye, but her fingers detected a tiny discontinuity. She pressed the discontinuity, twisted, turned, changed the angle of pressure several times, and repeated her effort. Nothing. Sitting back on her heels, Audrey studied the situation.
Here.
The warning sense had grown even more acute. She could feel it as a pressure on her breathing. Withdrawing slightly, she pulled her light back and lay full length on the floor to stare narrowly along the base of the threshold.
Here.
Could she place a tool there beside that word and lever the threshold? No. A tool was not indicated. This thing had the smell of the tyrant, not of a reverend mother. She tried to push the threshold sideways. Nothing moved. Feeling the tensions and danger sense accentuated by frustration, Audrey stood and kicked at the threshold beside the etched word. It moved. Something grated roughly against sand over her head. Audrey dodged backward as sand cascaded onto the floor in front of her. A deep rumbling sound filled the tiny chamber. The stones shook under her feet. The floor tipped downward in front of her toward the doorway, opening a space under the door and its wall. Once more, Audrey found herself precipitated forward and down into an unknown. Her light tumbled with her, its beam rolling over and over. She saw mounds of dark reddish brown in front of her. cinnamon filled her nostrils. She fell beside her light onto a soft mounding of melange. The opening through which she had fallen lay out of reach, some 5 meters overhead. She grabbed up her light. Its beam picked out wide stone steps cut into the rock beside the opening, something written on the risers. But she saw only that there was a way out. Her first panic subsided, but the sense of danger left her almost breathless, forcing the movements of her chest muscles. Left and right, she sent the beam of her light into this place where she had fallen. It was a long room directly beneath the passage she had taken from the great chamber. The entire length of it was piled with melange. Audrey probed upward with her light and saw why no searcher tapping on that passage floor overhead had detected this chamber. Criss-crossed rock bracings transferred all strain deep into the stone walls. Any tapping overhead would get back the sounds of solid rock. Once more, Audrey looked at the melange around her. Even at today's tank-deflated prices, she knew she was standing on a treasure. This hoard would measure many long tons. Is that the danger? The warning sense within her remained just as acute as ever. The tyrant's melange was not what she should fear. The triumvirate would make an equitable distribution of this lot, and that would be the end of it, a bonus in the Gola project. Another danger remained. She could not avoid the warning. Again, she sent the light beam along the mounded melange. Her attention was drawn to the strip of wall above the spice. More words. Still in Chekobsa, written with a cutter in a fine flowing script, there was another message. A reverend mother will read my words. Something cold settled in Odraid's guts. She moved to her right with the light, ploughing through an empire's ransom in melange. There was more to the message. I bequeath to you my fear and loneliness. To you I give the certainty that the body and soul of the Bene Gesserit will meet the same fate as all other bodies and all other souls. Another paragraph of the message beckoned to the right of this one. She ploughed through the cloying melange and stopped to read, What is survival if you do not survive whole? Ask the Bene Tlelax that. What if you no longer hear the music of life? Memories are not enough unless they call you to noble purpose. There was more of it on the narrow end wall of the long chamber. Audrey stumbled through the melange and knelt to read, Why did your sisterhood not build the golden path? You knew the necessity. Your failure condemned me, the God Emperor, to millennia of personal despair. The words God Emperor were not in Chekobsa, but in the language of the Islamiyat, where they conveyed an explicit second meaning to any speaker of that tongue. Your God and your Emperor because you made me so. Odraid smiled grimly. That would drive Waf into a religious frenzy. The higher he went, the easier to shatter his security. She did not doubt the accuracy of the tyrant's accusation, nor the potential in his prediction that the sisterhood could end. The sense of danger had led her to this place unerringly. Something more had been at work, too. The worms of Rakis still moved to the tyrant's ancient beat. He might slumber in his endless dream, but monstrous life, a pearl in each worm to remind it, carried on as the tyrant had predicted. What was it he had told the sisterhood in his own time? She recalled his words. When I am gone, they must call me Shaitan, Emperor of Gehenna. The wheel must turn and turn along the golden path. Yes, that was what Taraza had meant. But don't you see, the common people of Rakis have been calling him Shaitan for more than 1,000 years. So Taraza had known this thing. Without ever seeing these words, she had known. I see your design, Taraza. And now I know the burden of fear you have carried all these years. I can feel it every bit as deeply as you do. Odraid knew then that this warning sense would not leave until she ended, or the sisterhood vanished from existence, or the peril was resolved. Odraid lifted her light, got to her feet, and slogged through the melange to the wide steps out of this place. At the steps, she recoiled. More of the tyrant's words had been cut into each riser. Trembling, she read them as they moved upward to the opening. My words are your past. My questions are simple. With whom do you ally? With the self-idolaters of Tleilax? With my fish-speaker bureaucracy? With the cosmos-wandering guild? With the Harkonnen blood sacrifices? With the dogmatic stink of your own creation? How will you meet your end? As no more than a secret society? Adraid climbed past the questions, reading them a second time as she went. Noble purpose? What a fragile thing that always was, and how easily distorted. But the power was there, immersed in constant peril. It was all spelled out on the walls and stairs of that chamber. Terraza knew without having it explained. The tyrant's meaning was clear. Join me. As she emerged into the small room, finding a narrow ledge along which she could swing herself to the door, Odraid looked down at the treasure she had found. She shook her head in wonder at Terraza's wisdom. So that was how the sisterhood might end. Terraza's design was clear, all the pieces in place, nothing certain. Wealth and power, it was all the same in the end. The noble design had been started and it must be completed, even if that meant the death of the sisterhood. What poor tools we have chosen. That girl waiting back there in the deep chamber below the desert. That girl and the gola being prepared on Rakis. I speak your language now, old worm. It has no words, but I know the heart of it. Our father ate manna in the desert, in the burning place where whirlwinds came. Lord, save us from that horrible land. Save us, oh, save us from that dry and thirsty land. Songs of Gurney Halleck, Museum of Dar es Balat. Teg and Duncan, both heavily armed, emerged from the no-globe with Lucilla into the coldest part of the night. The stars were like needle points overhead, the air absolutely still until they disturbed it. The dominant smell in Teg's nostrils was the brittle mustiness of snow. The odor infused every breath, and when they exhaled, fat clouds of vapor puffed around their faces. Tears of cold started in Duncan's eyes. He had been thinking much of old Gurney as they prepared to leave the no-globe. Gurney with his cheek scarred by a Harkonnen ink-vine whip. Trusted companions would be needed now, Duncan thought. He did not trust Lucilla much, and Teg was old. Old. Duncan could see Teg's eyes glinting in the starlight. Slinging a heavy antique laser gun over his left shoulder, Duncan thrust his hands deep into his pockets for warmth. He had forgotten how cold this planet could get. Lucilla seemed impervious to it, obviously drawing warmth from one of her Bene Gesserit tricks. Looking at her, Duncan realized he had never trusted the witches much. Not even the Lady Jessica. It was easy to think of them as traitors, devoid of any loyalty except to their own sisterhood. They had so damned many secret tricks. Lucilla had given up her seductive ways, though she knew he meant what he had said. He could feel her anger simmering. Let her simmer. Teg stood quite still, his attention focused outward, listening. Was it right to trust the single plan he and Buzmali had worked out? They had no backup. Was it only 8 days ago they had settled on it? It felt longer, despite the press of preparations. He glanced at Duncan and Lucilla. Duncan carried a heavy old Harkonnen laser gun, the long field model. Even the extra charge cartridges were heavy. Lucilla had refused to carry more than a single tiny laser gun in her bodice. One small burst was all it held, an assassin's toy. We of the Sisterhood are noted for going into battle with only our skills as weapons, she said. It diminishes us to change that pattern. She had knives in her leg sheaths, though. Teg had seen them. Poison on them, too, he suspected. Teg hefted the long weapon in his own hands, a modern field-style laser gun he had brought from the keep. Over his shoulder, a mate to Duncan's weapon hung from its sling.
I must rely on Buzmali, Teg told himself. I trained him. I know his qualities. If he says we trust these new allies, we trust them.
Buzmali had been obviously overjoyed to find his old commander alive and safe. But it had snowed since their last encounter, and the snow lay all around them, a tabula rasa upon which all tracks would be written. They had not counted on snow. Were there traitors in weather management? Tegg shivered. The air was cold. It felt like the chill of off-planet space, empty and giving starlight free access to the forest glade around them. The thin light reflected cleanly off the snow-covered ground and the white dusting on the rocks. Dark outlines of conifers and the leafless branches of deciduous trees displayed only their whitely diffused edges. All else was deepest shadow. Lucilla blew on her fingers and leaned close to Tegg to whisper, "Shouldn't he be here by now?" He knew that was not her real question. Can Basmali be trusted? That was her question. She'd been asking it one way and another ever since Tegg had explained the plan to her 8 days ago. All he could say was,
"I have staked my life on it."
"Our lives too."
Tegg too disliked the accumulated uncertainties, but all plans relied ultimately on the skills of those who executed them.
"You're the one who insisted we must get out of there and go on to Rakis,"
he reminded her. He hoped she could see his smile, a gesture to take the sting out of his words. Lucilla was not placated. Tegg had never seen a Reverend Mother this obviously nervous. She would be even more nervous if she knew of their new allies. Of course, there was the fact that she had failed to carry out her full assignment from Terraza. How that must gall her.
"We took an oath to protect the Gola," she reminded him.
"Basmali has taken that same oath."
Tegg glanced at Duncan standing silently between them. Duncan gave no sign that he heard the argument or shared the nervousness. An ancient composure held his features motionless. He was listening to the night, Tegg realized, doing what all three of them should be doing just now. There was an odd look of ageless maturity on his young features.
"If ever I needed trusted companions, it's now," Duncan thought.
His mind had gone questing backward into the Gedi Prime days of his pre-Gola roots. This was what they had called a Harkonnen night. Safe within the warm shielding of their suspensor-buoyed armor, the Harkonnens had enjoyed hunting their subjects on such nights. A wounded fugitive could die of the cold. The Harkonnens knew, damn their souls. Predictably, Lucilla caught Duncan's attention with a look that said,
"We have unfinished business, you and I."
Duncan turned his face up into the starlight, making sure she could see his smile, an offensive and knowing look that caused Lucilla to stiffen inwardly. He slipped the heavy laser gun from his shoulder and checked it. She noted the ornate scrollwork on its stock and along the barrel. It was an antique, but still it gave off a deadly sense of purpose. Duncan rested it over his left arm, right hand on the grip, finger on the trigger, exactly as Tegg was carrying his own modern weapon. Lucilla turned her back on her companions and sent her senses probing onto the hillside above them and below. Even as she moved, sound erupted all around. Globs of sound filled their night, a great burst of rumblings off to the right, then silence. Another burst from downslope. Silence. From upslope, on all sides. At the first sound, all three of them crouched into the shelter of the rocks outside the No-Globe's cave entrance. The sounds filling their night carried little definition. Intrusive racketing, partly mechanical, partly squeaks and wails and hisses. Intermittently, a subterranean drumming made the ground vibrate. Tegg knew these sounds. There was a battle going on out there. He could hear the background hissing of burners, and in the distant sky the lancing beams of armored laser guns. Something flashed overhead, trailing blue and red sparks. Another and another. The earth trembled. Tegg inhaled through his nose, burned acid and a suggestion of garlic.
"No ships. Many of them."
They were landing in the valley below the ancient No-Globe.
"Back inside," Tegg ordered.
As he spoke, he saw it was too late. People were moving in from all around them. Tegg lifted his long laser gun and aimed it downslope toward the loudest of the intrusive noises and the nearest detectable movement. Many people could be heard shouting down there. Free glow-globes moved among the screening trees, let loose by whoever came from there. The dancing lights drifted upslope on a cold breeze. Dark figures moved in the shifting illumination.
"Face dancers,"
Tegg grunted, recognizing the attackers. Those drifting lights would be clear of the trees within seconds and on his position in less than a minute.
"We've been betrayed," Lucilla said.
A great shout roared from the hill above them.
Basha!
Many voices. Basmali? Teg asked himself. He glanced back in that direction and then down at the steadily advancing face dancers. No time to pick and choose. He leaned toward Lucilla.
That's Basmali above us. Take Duncan and run.
But what if...
It's your only chance.
You fool, she accused, even as she turned to obey. Teg's,
yes,
did nothing to ease her fears. This was what came of depending on the plans of others. Duncan had other thoughts. He understood what Teg was about to do, sacrifice himself that two might escape. Duncan hesitated, looking at the advancing attackers below them. Seeing the hesitation, Teg blared at him,
This is a battle order! I am your commander!
It was the closest thing to voice Lucilla had ever heard from a man. She gaped at Teg. Duncan saw only the face of the old Duke, telling him to obey. It was too much. He grabbed Lucilla's arm, but before hustling her up the slope, he said,
We'll lay down a covering fire once we're clear.
Teg did not respond. He crouched against a snow-dusted rock as Lucilla and Duncan scrambled away. He knew he must sell himself dearly now, and there must be something else. The unexpected. A final signature from the old Basha. The advancing attackers were coming up faster, exchanging excited shouts. Setting his laser gun on Maxibeam, Teg pressed the trigger. A fiery arc swept across the slope below him. Trees burst into flame and crashed. People screamed. The weapon would not perform long at this discharge level, but while it did, the carnage produced its desired effect. In the abrupt silence after that first sweep, Teg shifted his position to another screening rock on his left, and again sent a flaming lance down the dark slope. Only a few of the drifting glow globes had survived that first slashing violence, with its falling trees and dismembered bodies. More screams greeted his second counterattack. He turned and scrambled across the rocks to the other side of the no-globe's access cave. There he sent sweeping fire down the opposite slope. More screams. More flames and crashing trees. No answering fire came back.
They want us alive.
The Tleilaxu were prepared to spend whatever number of face-dancer lives it required to run his laser gun out of its charges. Teg shifted the sling of the old Harkonnen weapon to a better position on his shoulder, getting it ready to swing into action. He discarded the almost empty charge in his modern laser gun, recharged it, and rested the weapon across the rocks. Teg doubted he would get the chance to recharge the second weapon. Let them think down there that he had run out of charge cartridges. But there were two Harkonnen handguns in his belt as a last resort. They would be potent at close range. Some of the Tleilaxu masters, the ones who ordered such carnage, let them come closer. Cautiously, Teg lifted his long laser gun from the rock and moved backward, drifting up into the higher rocks, slipping left and then right. He paused twice to sweep the slopes below him with short bursts, as though conserving the gun's charge. There was no sense in trying to conceal his movements. They would have a life tracer on him by now, and besides, there were the tracks in the snow.
The unexpected.
Could he suck them in close? Well above the no-globe's access cave, he found a deeper pocket in the rocks, its bottom filled with snow. Teg dropped into this position, admiring the fine field of fire this new vantage provided. He studied it briefly, protected behind him by higher crags and open downslope on three sides. He lifted his head cautiously and tried to see around the screening rocks upslope. Only silence there. Had that shout come from Basmali's people? Even so, there was no guarantee that Duncan and Lucilla could escape in these circumstances. It depended on Basmali now.
Is he as resourceful as I always thought?
There was no time to consider the possibilities or change a single element of the situation. Battle had been joined. He was committed. Teg drew a deep breath and peered downslope over the rocks. Yes, they had recovered and were resuming the advance, without telltale glow-globes this time, and silently now. No more shouts of encouragement. Teg rested the long laser gun on a rock in front of him and swept a burning arc from left to right in one long burst, letting it fade out at the end in an obvious loss of charge. Unslinging the old Harkonnen weapon, he readied it, waiting in silence. They would expect him to flee up the hill. He crouched behind the screening rocks, hoping there was enough movement above him to confuse the life tracers. He still heard people below him on that fire-racked slope. Teg counted silently to himself, spacing out the distance, knowing from long experience how much time the attackers would require to come within deadly range, and he listened carefully for another sound he knew from previous encounters with the Tleilaxu, the sharp barking of commands in high-pitched voices. There they were. The masters were spread out farther downslope than he had anticipated. Fearful creatures. Tegg set the old lasergun on Maxibeam and lifted himself suddenly from his protective cradle in the rocks. He saw the arc of advancing face dancers in the light of burning trees and brush. The high-pitched voices of command came from behind the advance, well out of the dancing orange light. Aiming over the heads of the nearest attackers, Tegg sighted beyond the jumble of flames and pressed the trigger. Two long bursts, back and forth. He was momentarily surprised by the extent of the destructive energy in the antique weapon. The thing obviously was the product of superb craftsmanship, but there had been no way to test it in the no-globe. This time the screams carried a different pitch, high and frantic. Tegg lowered his aim and cleared the immediate slope of face dancers, letting them feel the full force of the beam, revealing that he carried more than one weapon. Back and forth, he swept the deadly arc, giving the attackers plenty of time to see the charge ebb into a final sputter. Now, they had been sucked in once and would be more cautious. There just might be a chance to join Duncan and Lucilla. This thought full in his mind, Tegg turned and scrambled out of his shelter across the upslope rocks. At his fifth step, he thought he had run into a hot wall. There was time for his mind to recognize what had happened. The shocking blast of a stunner full into his face and chest. It came from directly upslope where he had sent Duncan and Lucilla. Chagrin filled Tegg as he fell into darkness. Others could do the unexpected, too.
All organized religions face a common problem, a tender spot through which we may enter and shift them to our designs. How do they distinguish hubris from revelation? Missionaria Protectiva, the Inner Teachings. Odraid kept her gaze carefully away from the cool green of the quadrangle below her, where Shiana sat with one of the teaching sisters. The teaching sister was the best, precisely fitted to this next phase in Shiana's education. Terraza had chosen them all with care.
"We proceed with your plan," Odraid thought. "But did you anticipate, Mother Superior, how we might be marked by a chance discovery here on Rakkas?"
Or was it chance? Odraid sent her gaze over the lower rooftops to the spread of the Sisterhood's central stronghold on Rakkas. Rainbow tiles baked out there in glaring noon light.
All of this ours.
This was, she knew, quite the largest embassy the priests permitted in their holy city of Keen, and her presence in this Bene Gesserit stronghold defied the agreement she had made with Tuok. But that had been before the discoveries at Siech Tabor. Besides, Tuok no longer really existed. The Tuok who marched the priestly precincts was a face dancer living out a precarious charade. Odraid brought her thoughts back to Waf, who stood with two guardian sisters behind her, waiting near the door of this penthouse sanctuary, with its fine view through armor plaza windows, and its impressive black furnishings into which a robed reverend mother might blend with only the lighter shades of her face visible to a visitor. Had she gauged Waf correctly? Everything had been done precisely according to Missionaria Protectiva teachings. Had she opened the crack in his psychic armor sufficiently? He should be goaded to speak soon. Then she would know. Waf stood back there calmly enough. She could see his reflection in the plaza. He gave no sign of understanding that the two tall, dark-haired sisters flanking him were there to prevent his possible violence. But he certainly knew.
My guardians, not his.
He stood with his head bent to conceal his features from her, but she knew he was uncertain. That part was sure. Doubts could be like a starving animal, and she had fed those hungry doubts well. He had been so sure that their venture into the desert would be the occasion for his death. His Zen Sunni and Sufi beliefs were telling him now that God's will preserved him there. Surely, though, Waf was reviewing now his agreement with the Bene Gesserit. seeing at last the ways he had compromised his people, how he had put his precious Tlaylaxu civilization in terrible jeopardy. Yes, his composure was wearing thin, but only Bene Gesserit eyes detected this. It would be time soon to begin rebuilding his awareness into a pattern more amenable to the sisterhood's needs. Let him stew a bit longer. Odrade returned her attention to the view, loading the suspense of this delay. The Bene Gesserit had chosen this embassy location because of the extensive rebuilding that had changed the entire northeastern quarter of the old city. They could build and remodel here in their own way and for their own purposes. Ancient structures designed for easy access by people on foot, wide lanes for official ground cars, and occasional squares in which ornithopters might land. All of that had been changed.
Keeping up with the times.
These new buildings stood much closer to the green-planted avenues whose tall and exotic trees flaunted their enormous water consumption. Thopters were relegated to rooftop landing pads on selected buildings. Pedestrian lanes clung to narrow elevations attached to the buildings. Coin-operated, key-operated, and palm identification lift slots had been inset into the new buildings, their glowing energy fields masked by dark, brown, vaguely transparent covers. The lift slots were spines of darker colour in the flat grey of plascrete and plaz. Humans dimly seen in the tubes gave the effect of impurities moving up and down in otherwise pure mechanical sausages.
All in the name of modernization.
Waff stirred behind her and cleared his throat. Audrey did not turn. The two guardian sisters knew what she was doing and gave no sign. Waff's mounting nervousness was merely confirmation that all went well. Audrey did not feel that all was going truly well. She interpreted the view out her window as just another disquieting symptom of this disquieting planet. Tuak, she recalled, had not liked this modernization of his city. He had complained that some way must be found to stop it and preserve the old landmarks. His face dancer replacement continued that argument. How like Tuak himself this new face dancer was? Did such face dancers think for themselves or just play out their parts in accordance with a master's orders? Were they still mules, these new ones? How much different were these face dancers from the fully human? Things about the deception worried Odrade. The Force Tuak's counselors, the ones fully involved in what they thought of as the Tlaylaxu plot, spoke of public support for modernization and openly gloated that they had their way at last.